Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 19th of July, these are our main stories. European Union leaders in Brussels to negotiate an economic recovery package hope fresh proposals can end the deadlock. In Russia, thousands more join protests in support of a local governor who's been arrested and charged with ordering at least two murders.
Everybody understands that it's a political case. They have stolen him, our governor, from us. So they just took him, and everybody feels like we elected him. It was our choice, and Moscow took him.
Also in this podcast, the Taliban reshuffle their negotiating team in Doha. What does it mean for the chance of peace in Afghanistan? And why smiling while wearing a mask does matter. As the World Health Organization says the number of recorded coronavirus cases in a day has passed a quarter of a million, EU leaders are in Brussels trying to thrash out a COVID-19 financial rescue plan. They've already talked for 2 days and say they'll meet again on Sunday. At stake is agreement on a recovery package to mitigate the effects of the pandemic, with grants worth 450 billion euros on the table. Earlier, the Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, said while there'd been some movement, there was still disagreement on important matters.
The question of how we can ensure that the money is used correctly is still unanswered. So, for a green economy, for digitalization, for the necessary reforms, especially in some member states where there needs to be more competitiveness. And the question of the rule of law is still open, where Hungary and Poland have a very clear position, which we don't agree with. On that, there was still no breakthrough in the negotiations.
I asked our Europe correspondent Gavin Lee what progress has been made.
The air has freshened, that's what the Dutch spokesperson said. You know, the old irritation that people felt with Mark Rutte for being so forceful, you know, more so, we're told, than the other three of the frugal four, with the Danes, the Swedes and the Austrians. And the concept has come in today to sort out this recovery fund, 750 billion euros, which will be raised on the financial markets. Don't mention the fact that they've got to decide the budget, which is over a trillion euros. You know, that's another big obstacle. But they've been so detailed today, all the leaders, on the recovery fund. Apparently, there's been barely a mention of that. Charles Michel, the president of the European Council, is suggesting that countries can apply for money in the form of grants because of the 750 billion euros, 500 billion of it will be dispersed as grants. Charles Michel is saying, OK, my proposal now is that you can object to this as a member state. What Mark Rutte wanted, the Dutch wanted, was an absolute veto.
It sounds like an awful lot of money on the table. Is there any chance of it being paid back?
Not for the grants. The idea of the grants is a subsidy. It's a one-off payment. And, you know, what the Austrians, the Danes and the Swedes and the Dutch were saying, the Frugal Four, was that they wanted guarantees that if this money goes in the form of a grant, then it is a guarantee that this point won't happen again, as in the Italians won't ask for any more, and if they do, it won't be the same mechanism. The other point to come back with is clearly that those four countries were pushing for the amount to be reduced, and what the European Council have done through Charles Michel this afternoon is reduce the amount in proposing 450 billion in grants, the rest of the 750 billion in loans. So there's been some shift. Hungary was another issue as well. Viktor Orban was saying that some of these funds were basically on condition that you follow the rule of law, the spirit of the European Union. And given that there have been proceedings, investigations against Hungary for its removing of certain judges, for its alleged control of the media, Viktor Orban was saying that he would leave the summit, not join this thing, if they included conditions. Now, Hungary today have been promised an extra 3.6 billion euros as part of this pot, but still been told you have to follow the rules of the European Union law. So a bit of haggling going on. I think we're probably about 15 sets of face masks away per leader from a deal going through. They're calling it a three-day summit, but I'm told at the moment there could be another emergency summit before there's any sign of white smoke.
Gavin Lee in Brussels. Tens of thousands of Russians have taken to the streets for a seventh day in the far eastern city of Khabarovsk to demand the release of the local governor. They claim that the arrest of Sergei Furgal was politically motivated. Last week, he was flown under police guard 6,000 kilometres west to the capital, Moscow, charged with links to multiple historic murders. There are accusations that the Kremlin is using the arrest as a way to remind regional leaders of who's in charge in Russia after governors were given more powers to tackle the coronavirus crisis. Smaller protests have also taken place in other towns and cities. From Khabarovsk, our correspondent Steve Rosenberg reports.
They poured in from across the region. Freedom, they chanted. And send him home. It was one of the largest protests Khabarovsk has ever seen. Seven time zones east of Moscow. They've been taking to the streets for a week now. Sergei Furgal is the local governor. We're all Furgal, he says. He's popular here, more popular, they say, than President Putin. But last week, he was arrested. Officers flew in from Moscow, bundled him into a car, and flew him back to the capital. He's been charged with involvement in murders dating back 15 years, and that sparked anger in Khabarovsk.
Everybody understands that it's a political case. They have stolen him, our governor, from us. So they just took him, and everybody feels like we elected him. It was our choice, and Moscow took him.
What is remarkable about these scenes is that in Russia, unauthorized protests like this are normally broken up. But the police just stood and watched. The Russian authorities clearly trying to avoid creating even more anger on the streets and more resentment of Moscow.
Such a public display of dissent is embarrassing for the Kremlin. President Putin likes to portray himself as the man who has given Russia stability, but this protest is undermining that image.
We did find one man in Khabarovsk who's against the protests. The city's mayor. He's from the Kremlin's party.
We have seen certain people going to the protests, shouting the same slogans and acting inappropriately. And they're being paid to do this.
There's no evidence of that. All they want is for their governor to be given a fair trial in Khabarovsk. But the danger for the Kremlin is that if this continues, a local hero could become a national star.
Steve Rosenberg. How many people in Iran have been infected with the coronavirus? The country's president, Hassan Rouhani, says it could be as high as 25 million, which is almost 100 times higher than official statistics. The government has been repeatedly accused of underreporting the number of cases and deaths. I asked Khazra Naji from BBC Persian whether the 25 million figure was a worst-case scenario.
It is indeed, and it looks as if he's preparing the country for the worst, one. And secondly, that he's talking, he seems to be talking about the need for herd immunity as a way out of crisis for Iran. He says 25 million people have contracted COVID so far. That is based on an estimate on a worst-case scenario by the health ministry. And that seems to be based on the fact that, okay, we have so many people hospitalized and tested positive for corona, therefore we can project this to the rest of the population. That will work out as roughly 25 million people. And then he goes on to say that on the basis of that, we're going to expect another 30 million, 35 million people to contract it. But he says out of every 1,500 or so don't show any signs of it. So basically, He's talking about the whole of the country. The population of 80 million people will sooner or later contract it. Half the population will not show any signs of it, will not feel it.
But it sounds more of a guess, as you said, on the worst case scenario. Are they not keeping really specific figures?
No, this is what they're projecting. And the signs are today that we are in the middle of a second wave of pandemic in Iran. The first phase peaked in April, then it came down in early May when the Iranian authorities opened up businesses and started public transport, and then it went up again. And then today we are higher in terms of number of deaths than we were 3 months ago. So we are in a bad shape, and he expects hospitalization to double already. In the BBC Persian, we're getting reports that hospital beds are short and they're running out, and hospitals are being inundated.
Kasra Naji from BBC Persian. Germany has been relying on testing, tracing and now technology to control the number of COVID-19 infections in the country. More than 15 million people have now downloaded a coronavirus tracking app. But Germany's health minister has admitted he's worried that as people head off on their summer holidays, they might bring the virus back, undermining efforts to keep the outbreak under control. Jenny Hill sent us this report.
Attention, please. We'd like to point out that you are obliged to wear face masks throughout the terminal.
This is Germany's largest airport. Just a few weeks ago, it was almost at a standstill. Now, well, this country's back on the move.
Bitte halten Sie einen Abstand von mindestens einer.
But how to stop the virus spreading too? Germany's testing more, 500,000 tests last week. And in a brightly lit hall at Frankfurt Airport, for a fee, travellers can get a test too.
Anyone can turn up here for a test. You get the results within 3 hours or around 7 hours, depending on how much you're willing to pay.
Dr. Peter Bauer tells us that 3 to 5 people a day test positive here. Many of them are asymptomatic.
You see the people here, they are young. It's not the nursing homes showing up here. It's really young travellers. Usually they have nothing or slight symptoms that they did not link with a COVID-19.
Tracking infection is important too. Even on a pleasant day like this, sat at a pavement cafe with children playing in a fountain nearby, you're reminded of the virus. Because at every bar, restaurant, cafe, you have to fill out a form, leaving your contact details. And if I pick up my phone, I see the app, which for a month now, every German has been able to download.
Every time I, or rather my phone, comes into close proximity with someone else and their phone, it keeps a record. Now, it won't tell me who they were or where we met, but if within 14 days they test positive and tell the app, I'll get an automatic warning.
Around 1 in 5 Germans have downloaded the app. For privacy reasons, their data stays on the phone. The authorities can't see it.
Okay. Do you have an idea how you got this infection?
So it's unlikely to put Sylvia Morris out of work. She's from the local health authority, contacting people who've tested positive and tracing those they might have infected.
Recently, people have more contacts, like it was when it was the total shutdown. And by the beginning, the people, they had so many contacts. It was awful, you know.
Achtung bitte, wir weisen Sie darauf hin, dass im gesamten Terminal die Verpflichtung.
This country's got used to masks, distance, caution. But as Germany embarks on a very different holiday season, experts worry. Too easy, they say, to leave those cares behind.
For your own safety, please keep...
Jenny Hill in Berlin. Wearing face masks in public places is now commonplace, but while the science seems to show they can help protect people from the virus, what impact will they have on our relationships when no one can see us smile? Magdalena Rykloska is a lecturer in psychology at Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland.
The most important expression that's very much impaired with facial mask is the smile. So the smile is the most frequent facial expression, and the most distinctive feature of the smile is this movement of the mouth, and you have this contrast between the white teeth and the red mouth. So that makes the smile very recognizable from distance. And you can communicate many things with a smile. you can communicate that you're a trustworthy person, that you're a nice person, that you don't want to harm the other person, that you're feeling pleasure, joy, or even disgust or some sort of snarky, ironic emotion as well. And this is all lost or definitely reduced when you hide your lower face with a mask. One of the signs of the genuine smile versus a false smile is this shrinking of the eyes. It's this movement of that gives you crow's feet and the eyes. And that signals a genuine smile that also signals emotional intensity. So I found myself even making often exaggerated smile so that there's more information in the eye region, because eye contact is another very strong emotional signal. There's evidence in neuroscience that we can connect with the other person through eye contact, and eye contact triggers a process of some simulation of other person's emotion. We can deeply experience another person's emotion when looking in their eyes. So there's wrinkles around the eyes, there's eye contact, there's also gestures, so we can compensate with gestures or with a voice or with things like laughter, for example.
Magdalena Rykloska. Still to come in this podcast, we hear from chaplains involved in the fight against COVID, who describe the situation as worse than war.
It was very scary, very dangerous, very, very dangerous. I was closer to death in this pandemic than I was on the front lines of Desert Storm.
But first, when will the long-awaited talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban finally get underway? They were supposed to have started in March, weeks after the signing of a deal between the Taliban and the United States. But the delay continues, and the Taliban have announced significant changes to their negotiating team, bringing in new members, including the son of the movement's founder. So, what signal does that send? We've been hearing from Michael Semple, professor at Queen's University Belfast, who's in Kabul.
The Taliban's share of the negotiations is handled by a political commission. When there are changes made in the members of the political commission, and specifically the negotiation team, which is like a subset of that commission, they notify them through official announcements with proper headed notepaper. That hasn't happened. So the comment that we've got at the moment is basically kite flying. And, you know, we can see that there's something happening, but it isn't finalized.
Well, how do you interpret then the kite flying, as you called it? Because some journalists who follow the story closely are now putting out these reports about the changes to the negotiating team ahead of what are expected to be the inter-Afghan talks. We don't know when in the coming weeks, it's assumed.
So it's a signal to the US that, look, we're taking taking these talks very seriously. There is also intense factional play going on inside the Taliban. We know that one faction certainly wants to show that Maulvi Yaqub, son of the movement's founder, is the emerging supreme power. But there are several other factions jostling as well. So part of this kite flying is people trying to demonstrate how powerful they are by saying that, you know, either that our people are in the negotiating team or we can pick a negotiating team. But actually, they tend to reach consensus before they put out official announcements. The longer any member of the Taliban spends in the political commission, sitting in Doha, meeting with the Americans, meeting with other Afghans and people from around the world, the more that the Taliban leaders sitting in Pakistan seem to distrust them and suspect that they've been somehow, their loyalty has been bought up by hostile intelligence agencies. So they like to try and recycle them or send more trusted loyalists over just in case that there's a sellout. And I just point out that there is certainly something real happening here. I have various friends in the Taliban who sort of report, we're heading to Quetta or Karachi, ready to fly to Qatar because we hear we've been appointed. And then they end up waiting because the appointments actually haven't been finalized, because whether you're in the Taliban movement or in Kabul politics, it's very difficult to get the consensus required to finalize official appointments.
Professor Michael Semple talking to Lise Doucette. When we talk about healthcare workers battling the coronavirus pandemic, we tend to think of intensive care doctors and nurses. But they're not the only people who play a vital role during a pandemic. Two chaplains have been sharing their experiences with our correspondent, Barbara Platt-Usher. Rocky Walker is a military veteran who's based at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, and Hali Dechidue is the senior staff chaplain at the Hebrew Rehabilitation Center in Boston.
I got to tell you, when this unit, and again, this was the first unit to go COVID, to walk on here then, it was terrifying.
Rocky Walker recorded this video diary at the height of the pandemic in New York City. A flood of coronavirus patients had overwhelmed the Heart Hospital where he worked as a chaplain.
I mean, it was so scary because we didn't know anything about it, and it just felt like I was going to catch it just by walking on the unit.
In Boston, Hali Dechidue volunteered to fight the virus, which was invading her chronic care facility.
It was scary because we had our little bubble and we were taking care of our little old people and we were safe. And all of a sudden we're going to open this COVID unit. I didn't think they'd want me. They need the doctors. They need the ventilators. They need the whatever.
So you need the doctors and the medicines, but you also need the prayers.
Yeah.
But they also needed to change the way they cared for the sick and dying.
A lot of the tools that we use as chaplains were put away. First, we have a mask on our face, so facial expression is almost gone except for our eyes. And then even much bigger than that is the contact. Almost all of my patients were not at a place where we could even communicate anyway. But their family members not being there and having to develop relationships over the phone with people we've never met, that was a challenge.
You're in this hazmat suit and you go from being a comforting presence to being one of the scary people. And so I had to figure out how to work around that. I learned how to maneuver my eyebrows a lot and to think about smiling with my eyes.
How could you give care and support to people who were dying if you couldn't be in the same room?
That was very difficult. In the room, that's lonely, but they're never alone the way I see it. And that was also a very comforting message to a lot of the families when I reminded them of their own faith traditions that we're not alone in this.
I ended up going into the room. I started my visits in the doorway, and then I wasn't supposed to touch them, but a hand on the shoulder even, through a blanket and two pairs of gloves, felt comforting. And then, rather than having a comforting family presence, they got an iPad.
Did it really feel like you were suddenly thrust to the front lines?
It really did. It was very scary, very dangerous, very, very dangerous. I was closer to death in this pandemic than I was on the front lines of Desert Storm.
I think offering people a sense of belonging is really important. And so offering people that point of connection, that they're not alone, is more important than whatever fear I might have had.
Hali Dechidue and Rocky Walker, both talking to Barbara Platt-Usher. French police say a fire that completely destroyed the organ in the medieval cathedral in Nantes may have been started deliberately. The blaze is now under control, as Hugh Schofield reports.
Shortly before 8 o'clock this morning, passers-by reported flames and black smoke spewing from the façade of the Gothic cathedral, which dominates the centre of Nantes. Swift intervention by more than 100 firefighters brought the blaze under control within about 3 hours, but not in time to save the great organ situated on the balcony overlooking the nave, which has now been completely destroyed. Investigators at the scene say they've detected 3 separate starting points for fire, which is why immediate suspicions are being directed at an act of arson. A criminal inquiry has been opened, though police are saying that for the moment all explanations, including accidental, are being examined.
Hugh Schofield. Dogs are well known for their sense of smell. Some are said to even be able to sniff out undiagnosed cancers in people. And it seems they have another kind of sixth sense. They can detect and navigate their way around using the Earth's magnetic field. Stephanie Prentice has more.
It's long been known that dogs have heightened senses, particularly when it comes to smell. But a new study suggests they may also have an advanced sense of direction due to their ability to tap into Earth's electromagnetic field. A team of researchers from the Czech University of Life Sciences used video cameras and GPS systems strapped to dogs, mostly mini dachshunds, and let them loose in a forest to chase an animal scent. They found that on their way back, the dogs took more efficient routes and would suddenly stop and run in alignment with the magnetic field of the terrain. To get a better idea of what was going on, the team repeated the experiment on several hundred trips over a 3-year period. They used various checks to rule out other reasons for the behaviour, including hiding the dog's owner and using different locations each time. The conclusion is that it's highly likely that dogs have an innate magnetic compass which helps them tap into electrical currents and navigate shortcuts. And the team's next plan? A fresh experiment using magnets to block the field and find out how powerful this magic compass really is.
Stephanie Prentice. The US flag has been flown at half-mast at the White House and all federal buildings in honour of John Lewis, the American civil rights campaigner who's died at the age of 80. John Lewis was the last speaker to survive from the March on Washington back in 1963, when Martin Luther King delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech. President Obama said Mr. Lewis believed that in all of us there exists the capacity for great courage, a longing to do what's right, and a willingness to love all people. Let's hear John Lewis in his own words, speaking to the BBC in 2013.
When I first heard Martin Luther King Jr., it inspired me. It moved me. This man spoke to my soul. I think in some strange way, he was saying to me, you can do something. You can make a contribution. I wanted to go and attend Troy State College. It was a school that had never admitted black students. So I wrote a letter to Martin Luther King Jr. and told him I needed his help. He wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery to meet with him. So in March of 1958, by this time I'm 18 years old, and I saw Martin Luther King Jr. standing behind a desk. I was so scared. And Dr. King spoke up and said, "Are you John Lewis? Are you the boy from Troy?" And from that day on, he started calling me the boy from Troy. We became friends. The first arrest for me occurred in Nashville. I was sitting there in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion, waiting to be served. And a waitress put up a sign at the lunch counter saying the counter is closed. And we continued to just sit and wait. I was beaten, arrested, and taken to jail. But when I was arrested, I felt so free. I felt so liberated. You arrest me? You beat me, you throw me in jail. Well, what else can you do to me? You kill me. But Dr. King said, it is better to die a physical death than to die a spiritual or psychological death. On the morning of August 28, 1963, when it was my time to speak, looking out over that crowd, I saw hundreds and thousands of young people fresh from the jails of the South, fresh from the struggle, the front line, there. And when it was my time to speak, I spoke. I did my best. When the march was all over, when Dr. King had finished speaking, we all were invited to come down to the White House and to meet with President Kennedy. He was like a proud father. He was saying, you did a good job, you did a good job. And when he got to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he said, and you had a dream. We were ready. We were prepared to go back to the American South and fight the good fight and to never, ever give up.
The voice of U.S. civil rights activist John Lewis, who's died at the age of 80. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.